Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. Coming up today, Jill Bevilacqua presents There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings and reflections for this 29th Sunday in Ordinary Time. And our regular guest Joan Lewis takes us behind the scenes here in the Vatican with news of all that's happening at the Synod of Bishops, plus a new pontifical council dedicated to the re-evangelization of our increasingly secular world. We begin today's programme then with the Gospel passage for the 29th Sunday in Ordinary Time, read to us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus told his disciples a parable on the necessity of praying always and not losing heart. Once there was a judge in a certain city who respected neither God nor man. A widow in that city kept coming to him, saying, "Give me my rights against my opponent." For a time he refused, but finally he thought, "I care little for God or man. But this widow is wearing me out. I'm going to settle in her favor, or she'll end by doing me violence." The Lord said, "Listen to what the corrupt judge has to say. Will not God then do justice to his chosen, who call out to him day and night? Will he delay long over them, do you suppose? I tell you, he will give them swift justice. But when the Son of Man comes, will he find any faith on the earth?"
Let's go straight to the protagonists in the parable our Lord tells this Sunday. First, the judge, described in different versions as unjust, corrupt, unscrupulous, unrighteous, or simply, as here, as a judge who respected neither God nor man. What kind of justice might anyone expect from a man like this? Certainly a widow, with probably no resources whatsoever, would have little chance of influencing a man of this sort. He would care little for her rights, that's for sure. And indeed, he decides in her favour only because she has worn him out with her persistence, and because he's afraid of what she might do next. Judges, wrote Francis Bacon in 1625, ought to remember that their office is to interpret law, not to make law or give law. And again, let judges also remember that Solomon's throne was supported by lions on both sides. Let them be lions, but yet lions under the throne. Solomon's wisdom as a judge has come down to us in one of the most famous of all Bible stories, that of the two women who claimed the same child. Both had given birth at the same time, but one of the babies had died. Each claimed that the live child was hers. To Solomon they went for a judgment as to whom the child belonged. "Bring me a sword," ordered Solomon, "and I will cut the child in half, so that each may have half." And at this the true mother cried out in protest, "Let her have the child, but do it no harm." And so Solomon knew she was the child's mother and handed her the babe. Judges of such caliber may be few and far between, but there are not many who have gone down in history as failing totally in their almost sacred task. There have been those one would not have relished meeting, such as the notorious Judge Jeffreys, whose trials in the English West Country of the followers of the Duke of Monmouth, rebels against the crown, earned him the name of the Hanging Judge. Certainly, men and women of the law, be they judges or advocates, walk a tightrope in a world where one false step, the acceptance of a single bribe, means the loss of personal integrity, never to be recovered. A man there was, himself the son of a judge, who followed the profession of advocate, and of whom it was written that,
"In all his great offices and doings for the king and the realm, so many years together, had from all corruption of wrongdoing or bribes taking, kept himself so clear that no man was able therewith once to blemish him or make just quarrel against him."
The man was Sir Thomas More, Lord Chancellor of Henry VIII, executed by the King in 1535 for refusing to recognise him as head of the English Church, and canonised saint 400 years later. But despite this declaration of More's integrity, quoted from the life of More written by his son-in-law, William Roper, attempts were made to blacken More's name by suggesting that he had accepted bribes. In Robert Bolt's play about More, A Man for All Seasons, the dramatist uses the example of the woman who sent More a silver cup, in the hope that when she brought her case before him, he would give judgment in her favour. But, the character says, as soon as he realised it was a bribe, he got rid of it. More was very well aware of the implications of accepting a bribe. As he says in the play, in office they offer you all sorts of things. The point was to be able to distinguish between a genuine gift and one which compromised the recipient. In one famous case, More was accused by a certain Parnell, against whom More had made a decree while Lord Chancellor, of having received a bribe from his adversary, a certain Vaughan. In Roper's words,
this Parnell to His Highness most grievously complained that Sir Thomas More, for making the same decree, had of the same Vaughan, unable for the gout to travel abroad himself, by the hands of his wife, taken a fair great gilt cup for a bribe.
The matter came before the Council of Lords, and Parnell told his tale and swore that More had admitted receiving the cup. But Thomas More was not only incorruptible, he was an astute lawyer and diplomat, and he had a delightful sense of humour. Roper tells us what happened next.
Whereupon Sir Thomas More desired their lordships that as they had courteously heard him tell the one part of his tale, so they would vouchsafe of their honours indifferently to hear the other. After which obtained, he further declared unto them that, albeit he had indeed, with much work, received that cup, yet immediately thereupon he caused his butler to fill it with wine, and of that cup drank to her, and that when he had done so, and she pledged him, then as freely as her husband had given it to him, even so freely gave her the same unto her again, to give unto her husband as his New Year's gift, which, at his instant request, though much against her will, at length yet she was fain to receive, as herself and certain other there presently before them deposed. Thus was the great mountain turned scant to a little molehill.
And Roper cannot resist another story in the same vein.
So I remember that at another time upon a New Year's Day, there came to him one Mistress Crocker, a rich widow, for whom, with no small pain, he had made a decree in the Chancery against the Lord Arundel, to present him with a pair of gloves and £40 in gold coin, in them for a New Year's gift. Of whom he thankfully receiving the gloves, but refusing the money, said unto her, Mistress, since it were against good manners to forsake a gentlewoman's New Year's gift, I am content to take your gloves, but as for your money, I utterly refuse. So, much against her mind, enforced he her to take her gold again.
From judges now, let us pass to widows, often cited in the scriptures. In the words of our Lord, the widow's mite, which was worth more than all the rest of the offerings cast into the temple treasury, because she of her want cast in all she had. And just before, he'd been telling the people to beware of the scribes, who devour the houses of widows under the pretence of long prayer. Our Lord's compassion for the widow of Nain and his restoring of her son to life. Back in the Old Testament, the Mosaic law declared, "You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you do afflict them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn." And St. James, in his letter, declares that Religion that is pure and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unstained from the world. Alas, none of these laws or instructions or acts of pity towards widows would have moved our unjust judge. One thing, and one thing alone, decides him to act in favour of the widow, her persistence. Like the dominant note in music, her plea cannot be ignored. In his poem, A Toccata of Galuppi's, Robert Browning imagines Galuppi, the 18th century composer from the island of Burano near Venice, sitting at the clavichord, and exclaims, "Hark, the dominant's persistence, till it must be answered to." And in the different versions of today's gospel, the theme is always the same, to persevere in prayer. Always to pray and not lose heart. Pray continually and never lose heart. We ought always to pray and not to faint. That last is a vivid image used often by writers. Shakespeare has one character say of another, "He prays but faintly and would be denied." And a 17th century metaphysical poet, Francis Quarles, wrote, "He teaches to deny that faintly prays." And Shakespeare again in Troilus and Cressida has Ulysses say to Achilles, who's losing heart, "Perseverance, dear my lord, keeps honour bright. To have done is to hang quite out of fashion, like a rusty mail in monumental mockery." Mail, of course, meaning coat of mail, for Ulysses was talking to a soldier. In our own Vatican Radio Almanac of Evening Thoughts, for September the 20th of the year 2000, we find these words of the French 19th century writer Victor Hugo. "Almost the whole secret of great souls is contained in this word, persevere." What emerges from these various reflections on perseverance in prayer seems to be that before we get a positive answer, we're going to have a lot of negative ones, or none at all. That this happens to even the most fervent of clergymen is borne out by this poem written by the man who's been described as the most purely devotional of English poets, George Herbert, 17th century metaphysical poet and country parson. Here now is Denial.
When my devotions could not pierce thy silent ears, then was my heart broken, as was my verse. My breast was full of fears and disorder. My bent thoughts, like a brittle bow, did fly asunder. Each took his way. Some would to pleasure go, some to the wars and thunder of alarms. As good go anywhere, they say, as to benumb both knees and heart, in crying night and day, "Come, come, my God, O come," but no hearing. O that thou shouldst give dust a tongue to cry to thee, and then not hear it crying. All day long my heart was in my knee, but no hearing. Therefore my soul lay out of sight, untuned, unstrung, my feeble spirit, unable to look right, like a nipped blossom, hung discontented. O cheer and tune my heartless breast, defer no time, that so thy favours granting my request, they and my mind may chime and mend my rhyme.
The great Teresa of Avila admitted that for years she'd found it hard to concentrate in prayer. But she wrote that God does not leave us without help if we approach him humbly. If a whole year passes without receiving what we ask, we should be ready to try longer. Such time is well spent. And the Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore puts the same thought into his own unique words.
Clouds heap upon clouds, and it darkens. Love, why dost thou let me wait outside at the dawn all alone? In the busiest moments of the noontide work, I am with the crowd. But on this dark, lonely day, it is only for thee that I hope. If thou showest me not thy face, if thou leavest me wholly aside, I know not how I am to pass these long, rainy hours. I keep gazing on the faraway gloom of the sky, and my heart wanders wailing with the restless wind. If thou speakest not, I will fill my heart with thy silence and endure it. I will keep still and wait like the night with starry vigil and its head bent low with patience. The morning will surely come, the darkness will vanish, and thy voice pour down in golden streams breaking through the sky. Then thy words will take wings in songs from every one of my birds' nests, and thy melodies will break forth in flowers in all my forest groves.
And you can join Sean Patrick Lovett and Jill Bevilacqua at this same time next week for another edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Right now, our regular guest Joan Lewis is here once again to take us behind the scenes at the Vatican, beginning with news of all that's been happening this week at the Synod of Bishops on the Middle East.
First of all, I know you've had some experience in the Middle East, too, and I have so many friends there. And I mean, Lebanon, the Holy Land, Iraq, obviously. So I've been looking forward to this synod for a long, long time, looking forward to seeing friends, looking forward to hearing their messages, because I know what they've told me over meals and in interviews and everything else about the difficulties they have as Christians in a land where they're always a minority. So to listen to some of the themes come out, and if you look at them, there's really some I expected to hear about, obviously, war, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, violence, terrorism, emigration as a result, Christians in certain lands being kidnapped, being killed, and obviously a family says, we're not going to stay here. So the Middle East, where Christianity was born, is beginning to not look very Christian at all. The numbers are dwindling.
So on the other side of that, though, we've also been hearing, haven't we, about the huge numbers of people coming in to work in the Middle East.
Yes,
so that Christian, new Christian population.
That came up perhaps midweek. I think is when I first became aware of those discussions. So that you have in countries of the Middle East, and the Synod was very clear to note that there are 16 countries, obviously. I won't name them all now, but I mean, you've got Abu Dhabi and you've got Dubai and you've got Doha, you've got Qatar and so forth. And you have tons and tons of Christians, in many cases Filipinos, that go into these countries to work. And in places like Saudi Arabia, they work in Saudi Arabia. They can't even wear a cross around their neck, much less, for heaven's sakes, go to a church or a chapel for mass. So their problem is being able to in some instances, be able to practice their faith, or B, not have enough priests to, and even of the different rites, to administer to them. And speaking of which, one interesting thing came up in a briefing yesterday. We should tell our listeners that the Synod Fathers meet in morning and afternoon sessions. They give speeches. They're allowed really only 5 minutes, which is far too short. But their speeches are then given to translators to be translated. So a couple of bulletins come out every day with the translations of the various speeches.
In you've the four got official languages.
Right. You've got Arabic, French, English, and Italian. So whatever language they speak in, you can get all of them, should we say, eventually in English. Now, in the evening from 6 to 7, they have a kind of private time. This is where people speak and they know that this is not going to be like on the record. That is to say, in a briefing, we will learn what people have said but not who said it. So it won't be a Lebanese or an Iraqi or a specific prelate that said something. So it's been in some of these evening sessions. And by the way, the Pope is always present. I've been told by participants he listens, you know, with avid interest. But again, one of the things that came up at these meetings, the private ones, if you will, was the need for what was called a bank of priests. Now, there's the priests who are needed in many, many countries. We know that in America we need more vocations too, and in Western Europe. And the idea is you've got these priests who are functioning priests. Not, they could be retired, but usually who would offer themselves for 3, 6, 9, 12 months in a place which would badly need a priest. Obviously, you have to know different rites if it's the case. case of going to some of the countries we've mentioned involved in the Synod. And I'd like to interrupt myself for a second because I think that so many people listening to us who might be of the, call themselves Roman Catholics, they're of the Latin Rite, don't realize, I've been asked, are these Catholic churches? Oh, yes, indeed, they are. So when you hear Melkite, Syriac, Maronite, Chaldean, these are Catholic churches. They are linked to Rome. They are obedient to Rome and the Holy Father. They are just different rites, different traditions, and different histories. So that has come up too. And one of the main themes of the Synod is communion, communion among these different churches who are very proud perhaps of their tradition or their rite and may not want to share some things, but this is an age in which we probably do need to share with, even mentioning a common Our Father. So all the different rites we've just mentioned, they'll have their own version of the Our Father. I don't know to tell you now what would be the distinguishing differences between them, but they suggest one way we could be bound together would be to have the Our Father.
There's a great need, isn't there, for, as you say, this communion amongst
yes.
not only the different rites, but also the different Christian churches. And we have, I think it's 13 ecumenical delegates, don't we, at the Synod,
yes.
who will be speaking during the second week.
We do, and we might want to point out to people that there are also representatives of the Jewish faith, and there is a Sunni, and there is a Shia Muslim. So that was one of the themes in the Instrumentum Laboris. It's one of the themes that we have heard from a number of the prelates who've been speaking. Some of the bishops get up and they talk maybe about really only one thing, the difficulty for Christians in their particular country, the violence, whatever. Others get up and touch on different matters. Two interesting proposals have been made regarding patriarchs. And people can say, what is a patriarch? I think we should probably do a separate show on that because we don't have that time in these shows. But the patriarch is the head of his particular church. I'll take Iraq because I know it so well. You have Patriarch Emmanuel Deli of Babylon of the Chaldeans. He lives in Iraq. He's patriarch head of that church still. And he happens to be a cardinal. There are three of the patriarchs who are cardinals, so they belong to the College of Cardinals. The suggestion was made that all of the patriarchs, I believe there's nine in attendance here, that all of the patriarchs, whether or not they have the rank or title of cardinal, that they be able to elect the Holy Father, so that they become a member of the college, which today we call the College of Cardinals. And then another suggestion that has come up relative to the role of the patriarch is that, for example, Patriarch Deli in Iraq, his authority would extend to the Chaldeans living in Iraq. Now, what about the Chaldeans that are in Michigan, the Chaldeans that are in Canada, the Chaldeans that are in San Diego, huge communities?
Diaspora.
Right, the diaspora, and they've got their own rights, they've got their own traditions, but most of them are living in generally what is a Latin Rite diocese. So can their authority, you've got two canon laws, you've got the Code of Canon Law for the Latin Church, you have the Code of Canons for the Oriental Churches. And in some respects, they dovetail. In other respects, they're very different. You even have something like sacraments. I learned that there are Eastern churches whereby children receive communion at very young ages. So if these children in a Middle Eastern country were to go, if the family were to go to the United States, say, or Canada or Australia, and they're in a Latin diocese, you're supposed to be 7 or 8 or the age for receiving First Communion, but they've already had it. So how do you stop them from receiving it? I don't think so, if they've been doing it. So those are little things that a lot of us even covering it didn't know about.
So it's a very complex picture, isn't it?
Oh, it
I
is.
I think that was reflected at the opening Mass with the many different traditions and liturgies represented right there.
Oh,
that first
the different
day
languages,
on the, Sunday.
The beautiful music. And I know in the first article that I wrote in my blog, I wrote Synod Fathers present the title of their talks here. Synod Fathers present complex messages from a complex region. It really is a kaleidoscope of traditions, colors, rites, languages. Fabulously interesting and fabulously beautiful. And I really do hope that people come away from what they've read in the media, from our shows and so forth, I hope they come away with a more beautiful idea of the richness of these rites and the variety. And yes, they're all Catholic too, you know. So
more on this next week, of course, after the
right.
second week of the Synod. It is only 2 weeks this year and not 3 weeks, as synods have been for so many years in the past. Time to look at a new council here in the Vatican, which was instituted, wasn't it, just this week?
Exactly. There was a press conference earlier in the week presided over by Archbishop Rino Fisichella, who is the president of the newly instituted Pontifical Council for Promoting the New Evangelization. And this is the, I did a little research, the first council to be erected since 1985. John Paul II in that year erected the Council for Healthcare Workers. So in 25 years, this is the first one. But Pope Benedict wrote an apostolic letter, motu proprio, which means by his own hand, entitled in its Latin title, Ubicumque et Semper, and I love it. It means always and everywhere. And so with that document, he established this new office. Archbishop Fisichella is the president. Other officers or officials, if you will be named secretary and the undersecretary, members, consultors. None of those people have been named yet. He's just hoping simply to find a desk in his new office with a computer on it. So,
and it's going to deal with evangelization,
re-evangelizing
of
exactly,
Christian
the new
countries which have become so secular over the last
exactly relativism.
Century.
Secularism, de-Christianization, because, and he was very careful to distinguish between the work of the congregation, which is centuries old, the Congregation for the Evangelization of Peoples, used to be called Propaganda Fide, spreading the faith, and they go where people have not yet received the gospel, they do not yet know of Christ, so they are bringing the good news to these people. However, with this council, like you said, with the relativism, Europe is... he was quite clear in saying Europe was going to be the first area they're going to turn to because it is so, you know, de-Christianized, the rampant relativism and secularism, and we just need to bring people back to the basics. And, you know, actually, if you listen to what the Pope has said since in these years that he's been the Pope— You hear Benedict talking about relativism and secularism so much and you know, how and why did this happen and why are we living as if there is no God? And it's almost like it was no surprise. If you read in between the lines, you could almost see him coming forth someday with, hey, we need a new office. And I think it's important to look at the fact he established a council. He didn't call for a meeting in Rome. He didn't call for a synod. He didn't send out a letter to the world's bishops and priests and lay faithful. He actually set up an office to deal
with
this.
Which is a much more lasting legacy, isn't
it? It is indeed. And you'll have input from all over the world. It will be constant. It won't be like a synod. Maybe at the end of 2 weeks, people do go home, although there's always, of course, follow-up. But Archbishop Fisichella said the council would be using all the new technology, obviously, so you can look forward probably to YouTube videos or Twitter or
so
whatever.
Very creative ideas
sure.
to make the faith relevant to these people in these countries today.
Exactly. And, you know, to bring the faith back, these are countries that were the first to receive Christianity, let's say in Europe and so forth, with the missionaries, and then your Spanish and so forth missionaries bringing it to the New World. Oh, which is very interesting. I thought about this. This was presented on October 12th, and of course, Columbus Day, the discovery of the New World, when on that date he supposedly, you know, landed in the New World. And then, of course, you had the bringing of the faith through the missionaries to the New World. So I am sure the Vatican did not plan on releasing this on Columbus Day, but I could not help as an American but make that link. So folks, something to look forward to, a new pontifical council and its work, and I wish them well. It's a huge task.
Thanks there to Joan Lewis. He'll be back again at this same time next week. And that's all from us here at the English Programme for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.